Like many of us across the country, we're very lucky to have great firefighters because when we need help, we need it. Now, and from people who know what they're doing. Here in Southern California, we're awfully lucky to have some of the best firefighters there are anywhere. And it happens to be on this podcast, you're going to hear from a few of them talking about these horrible fires that we've experienced this year. And it sounds like it may just be getting worse if we're to believe the federal government's report on global warming, a report that says disasters could become someday even more disastrous. Why don't we go around the room, introduce yourselves. Let's start with Captain Scott.
Sure, Captain Eric Scott with the Los Angeles Fire Department and currently the Public Information Officer.
Captain Brian McGrath of Ventura County Fire Department and also the Public Information Officer.
Captain Tony and Brenda, Los Angeles County Fire Department and also Public Information Officer.
Let's pick up on that Public Information Officer part because that's a significant job. And a lot of people may not exactly understand what that is. But basically, you're the liaison between the department you represent and people like me. And so when you're out in the field, one of your jobs is to provide information to us that we can in turn provide it back to the public.
Absolutely. Our job is to gather information, analyze what's pertinent, and disseminate it to the public. We think the middle letter of PIO is information. It's a commodity, just like food, water, and shelter. And we have responsibility for those that we serve to provide emergency public information.
Eric, how do you determine what's important for the public to know?
Well, currently, with the recent historic devastating wildfires, evacuations is probably one of the most paramount issues. So I think all my partners here, Captain and Brendan McGrath, would agree. We try to do three things to gain a fourth. We want to be timely, accurate, and consistent in our message, and that gets us credibility. When it comes to evacuations, we want and need that credibility so we could keep people safe.
It's not just credibility for evacuations, though. It's also credibility for just understanding what the fire behavior is, understanding what's threatened, what homes may be in the line of fire here, to use a term. It's also how many acres, how many this, how many that, because we get it from you. And so all that information is valuable. It's important, right, Brian?
Definitely very important. Something else is where the firefighters are at right now, where they're working.
And how many there are.
How many there are, where they're going to, how many are coming to help. And so it's very important that we get this information out correctly and as quickly as we can, because it's important for people to know, you know what, it's not necessarily evacuations, but now I can't travel that way. I can't get home from work. Major thoroughfares are shut down. Trains could be shut down. So it's important that we get this information out quickly.
Tony, during the recent Woolsey fire, you sort of became almost an MC at news conferences, yeah, introducing various public officials and council members. I think the governor was at one of those things.
Absolutely, yeah. Very challenging endeavor, something that it's ever-changing. You can set your program up and be ready to deliver it, and it's going to change on you 10 seconds before you're going to go on camera. So you need to be able to be kind of light on your feet and be able to accept injects and things that you may not be ready for, and just try to be as smooth and well-prepared with it as you can. And, you know, you have peaks and valleys as you go through that process.
For anybody who saw those news conferences, and I saw quite a few of them, I thought you did a very good job. You know, standing in front of cameras and talking, all of you are used to that. All of you have done it for a while. But sort of introducing the governor of the state of California, the mayor of Thousand Oaks, whatever it was that you were having to deal with.
And they're very particular about how they want that done. So trying to be
sensitive. What do they say to you?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, you can get everything from the order in which you announce them to the way you pronounce their names. People sometimes want to be mentioned that they're present and they don't want to speak, and they can throw a lot of complex, you know, ways that they want you to handle their presence. And you're trying to couple that with, you know, having your unified command speak and really give the public what they truly want to hear.
Generally speaking, what I think we in the media want to hear is from you guys as to what it is that we're dealing with and the enormity of it and the potential of it. But the public officials do provide important information, and they encourage their constituents to move out of their homes and do things like that, as they did with you in those news conferences. And I think anybody who can utter a few words like "you need to leave" and somebody believes them because they happen to trust that particular person, that's an important use of a human resource.
Absolutely. I think, you know, these a lot of our public officials, they have a lot of experience at this sort of thing. They have a certain degree of credibility that they bring to the table. And when they get up there and try to pass that information along to the public, you know, people listen. So it's important.
But we really, what we really listen to, though, Brian, is how fast is this thing growing? How bad are the winds? What's the impact of what's happening around us? And how dangerous is it?
Yeah, that's definitely what everyone wants to hear, because where is it going to? Do I need to evacuate? Do I need to be prepared before the evacuations get ordered? As we talked earlier today, and if you have a large animals and you need to get out, if you have elderly that you need to evacuate, you need to think about getting out before that evacuation order is given. So that information we're giving is, where is this fire going? Is it a practical threat to myself and my family?
One of the things we were talking about earlier, Brian, was the idea that embers fly. And because they fly, you may be in a part of a neighborhood where you'd think to yourself, well, I'm not in danger. I'm not anywhere near that foothill there. And really, you are in danger, because if that ember comes and hits your roof, all of a sudden you may be underneath the fire.
Yeah. The smaller, lighter, flashier fuels like grasses don't put off these big embers. You know, they burn light and fast, really fast. And they are hot. But their embers are not going nearly as far as the thicker, heavier brush that we have, which are moving up to 2-3 miles ahead of the flame front. And it's affecting homes that are well out of our urban interface. Urban interface for us is considered 500 feet of an open space area. So now you're affecting homes well out of that 500 feet in the middle of golf courses.
You know, one of the things I find interesting about embers, and I wouldn't mind talking about embers for a couple of minutes, they don't necessarily come floating down like a snowflake. You can have a whole cloud of these things at one time go whoosh, and suddenly you've got a real dangerous situation, right?
Well, they always do come in a cloud. They come in huge clusters, and really it's one of the most important things for us to recognize in the wildland environment, because our fire commanders are trying to look for areas in the fire where we can safely engage. And when you have a really substantial ember cast, trying to determine where you can safely engage that fire is difficult, because you can end up with fire in areas that you're not expecting it, behind you and closing off your areas of egress. And that's something that we're constantly trying to assess in the fire environment.
You're all public information officers, but you're also veteran firefighters. All
yes.
of you have been out mm-hmm. in the field fighting fires. What's the most dangerous thing you've ever found yourself involved in, Tony?
Me personally, it would be the wildland is definitely, I think, the most dangerous environment that we experience here in Southern California. But me personally, I think the most dangerous situation I was ever in was, we had an aircraft down with a trapped occupant where the aircraft was full of fuel, and we had to engage in an extrication of that pilot. We had to cut the fuselage of the aircraft, and we were unsure whether or not we were going to hit energized components, and we had fuel everywhere, and it was a very hazardous operation.
Have you woken up in the middle of a sleep, sweating, and thinking about that? That sounds awful.
Fortunately, I haven't, but, you know, there's still time.
You know? That sounds really, really bad.
Yeah.
Well, what about you, Brian?
Mine would have to be the Montecito mudslides.
Yeah.
That was when we're searching through that mud that at times was up to my nipple deep. Found out halfway through the search that pools were completely covered with mud. At any moment, you could fall in a 6-foot pool. There were no manholes left. Everything you reach for, you're looking for somebody. You're trying to find anything. So every branch looks like a body part. Every time you reach for that branch, you are hoping it's a body, but then you're also hoping it's not.
During the Thomas Fire, I was in an area of burned out homes. I was in the backyard of a home that was burned down, and there was a pool, and I knew to stay away from the pool. And I was walking around to get to the owner who was back there on the other side. There was a pond, like a koi pond, that I didn't realize was there because it was covered in ash. And when I stepped on it, I went straight down. Probably, and it was a deep pond. It feels to me like I went down to under my shoulders somewhere. And I was terrified. I knew the pool wasn't there because I didn't go down in the pool, but all of a sudden I was going down in water. I had no idea what was underneath me. All I knew is I was going down. And fortunately my feet hit the bottom, and I felt like I was okay. I was completely soaked, and it was a very unsettling feeling. I think, you know, and you guys end up in situations like that sometimes. You're as careful as you can possibly be, but sometimes there's something there you just didn't know was there.
Absolutely. And, you know, all firefighters and captains are looking for signs of failure. They're looking for fatigue. They're looking for danger areas. It's a constant situational awareness that's based upon the information that you're getting to stay out of those areas. And, you know, for I think to answer that question for me was on 7/31 of 2008. It was a just after midnight in North Hollywood. We had a large single-family dwelling fire, and I was involved in a partial roof collapse to the extent of being trapped inside the fire. But that's an instance to where all firefighters train for that.
You were trapped?
Correct.
In the fire, in the house. Take me back to that moment.
It was, like I said, just after midnight in North Hollywood. It was a large home. There was elderly individuals that were trapped inside. Our incident commander called for additional resources strategically. My engine company had what we call the Delta exposure, which is when you're looking at the front of the house, it'd be to the right of it. As we made entry from the rear, there was a portion of that roof collapse that transpired. Very dark outside. I literally don't remember going from standing to being bent in half, and then the weight of the roof was on the air bottle. But the thing is, that's just one example. You know, these other captains here and firefighters across the nation face those similar challenges. That's just some of what transpires in our chosen profession.
Yeah, but did you think that was the end, or did you think that somebody's going to come and help me here?
You know, I knew we had guys nearby. It didn't strike just me. I knew it struck one other individual. That individual was under partially collapsed, so
the roof.
Correct.
Yeah.
So resources went to him first due to seeing that I was completely buried, so they didn't quite know I was under there at that moment. But that's why we have a team effort. We train for firefighters that are three things, either down, missing, or trapped, and we have teams that come in to facilitate and rescue exactly that.
Well, it's great that you pulled out of that. I mean, I can't imagine a more frightening situation. I thought falling into a koi pond was a big deal.
Well, every fire, like what Captain Scott was talking about, one of the primary assignments that we make out there is what we call RIC, which is Rapid Intervention Crew. And at every fire, we assign a company to stage outside that fire and be ready with specialized equipment to be able to extricate a firefighter that may potentially become trapped or lost inside of what we call an IDLH, an immediately dangerous to life and health environment. So it's one of our primary functions during those operations.
You know, we've lost firefighters, and it's tragic when we do. And, you know, we see the funerals afterwards, and we see the entourages and the ladders with the flag, the ladders crossed in respect. You have a tough job. You have a tough job. And so as we see these fires get worse and we hear reports from the federal government of the potential of worsening global warming, which Cal Fire officials have said is here and it will get worse, they seem to concur with that report. What are the concerns that you have in light of that?
Well, we certainly are seeing an increase in frequency and duration of wildfires in Southern California. It's not deniable. We saw the Mendocino Complex, the Thomas Fire, Latuna Creek Skirball in the L.A. areas, and continuing on the Paradise Fire. So we do obviously see an increase in temperatures, a reduction in relative humidity, and the big component that moves these like a freight train is your Santa Ana winds. You compile that with the 6 out of 7 years of drought. Now you have vegetation that is very susceptible to a spark. The rain that did come created a grass crop, which is that light, flashy fuel. The challenge with that is it's easy to start, and it moves very quick, and then it gets into your bigger timber, And lastly, you now have multiple homes that are built in the beautiful enclaves of the wildland areas of Southern California. That means you got life and property to protect in that hazardous environment.
In 1982, there was a fire in Anaheim. It took out four blocks, took out 2,000 apartments, 1,000 people ended up permanently displaced. That fire was in a wind area, and what it affected were wood roofs. Mm-hmm. As a result of that 1982 fire, that resonated with legislators who came around to the idea that wood roofs were not a good thing to have, especially in a wind-prone area. And so they legislated this problem away. But we don't often hear about laws being changed from things we learn out of fires. That was one of the bigger ones. What are some of the other cases where we've learned something from a fire that we don't want to ever see happen again?
Well, we definitely learn from every fire. As a firefighter agency, you have three different patches in here right now. We learn from every incident we go on. So fire department is continually learning and moving and advancing our learning and our training. Some of the laws that have come up, though, are the hazard reduction programs that we all three agencies use. That's a law that has changed.
Explain that, will you?
It gives dispensable space in between urban interface mix where the structure and the brush reach. So that's definitely something that has grown and is very successful.
In Los Angeles City, there are new rules with regard to things like clearance and red flag days. And Eric, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. And like Captain McGrath mentioned, you know, brush clearance is so, so important. We would love to put a fire engine in front of every single home. We can't. So we want people to do their defense. We'll do the offense. So when they have that proper brush clearance, we'll be able to put a firefighter in between that wall of flame and in between that home and protect it. The challenges that we're seeing is that some well-intentioned individuals performing proper brush clearance in accordance with the municipal code have started fires. So in the recent past, there's been new ordinances that have gone through to reduce that problem. And some of the basics of that is to use, if they're using metal blades, to make sure that it's non-sparking or non-ferrous, they call it.
In other words, some kind of a device that might cut weeds made of metal, but you can't use that because it could spark, and that could spark a fire.
And we've seen that exactly happen. And then if one does spark, well, let's be logical. You need to have an extinguishing agent. So whether that's a fire extinguisher or a charged garden hose, that needs to be nearby. Let's not do this on a red flag day. That's now a rule, because that is when fire conditions are at their peak and one spark can spread into a wildfire. Two more things. One is, don't be distracted. Those individuals performing brush clearance can only be doing that per law now. And
what
lastly,
does that mean?
Well, that means you can't be distracted. And so some...
No texting?
You need a phone, and that's the fifth point, but that's to call 911 in case a fire goes out. But yeah, no texting, no other phone calls. You can't also be doing planting vegetation while you're doing fuel reduction or removing
because
vegetation.
Because you're distracted.
Exactly.
You may not realize you just started a fire.
And we've seen it happen in the Portola fire, I believe even one in Mandeville Canyon. Those well-intentioned individuals created a fire. So now we need to make sure, okay, well, hey, let's not get a metal that's going to cause a spark. Let's make sure you can put it out quick. Don't be distracted. Be able to call 911. Realize the potential and do not do it on a red flag day.
Do you guys want to pick up on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Captain Scott raises a very important point, is when we are in fire weather, the conditions are so volatile and the brush is so receptive to ignition, controlling your behavior in those areas is critical. People smoking cigarettes, riding motorcycles without spark arresters, engaging in any type of activity that could create an ignition source in that type of weather is extremely hazardous, because the ignition is so easy, it happens so readily, and then the rate of spread is so tremendous. A fire, you know, that would start in the brush during a spring day when we have high relative humidities and the temperatures aren't so low, or maybe we don't have wind behind that fire that gets out to a quarter acre in 10 minutes, will be out to 100 acres within minutes during red flag weather. So it creates the situation where we have to pour resources on these fires really early, or we are going to have an enormous fire in a very short period of time.
It's unbelievable to me, the enormous fires that we seem to have one after another after another. The town of Paradise went down in less than a day. That was unbelievable. The number of people killed up in the campfire, the fire we had down here with Woolsey. You know, these things are becoming like, you know, blockbuster movies. Like, they're almost unbelievable sometimes in their scope and their nature, their damage, and their destruction.
Right? Well, that's why people need to reassess their preparedness and be ready. You know, when we talk about that ready, set, go, and we talk about defensible space.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Tell everybody.
Well, defensible space being, you know, a minimum of 30 feet of no flammable vegetation or flammable items directly adjacent to your structure. 100 feet in any kind of a hazard area, 200 feet in high hazard areas. So it gives us that ability to operate. That's being ready. Being set is having that emergency kit available at all times. So everything that you need, you don't have to go hunting for it. If the evacuation orders come out, you have that stuff ready to go. You grab it, you're out of there. Evacuating early is the most critical thing that we can communicate to the public. This incident here was an enormous success by the standpoint of lives saved. And when this thing was at its height, we had approximately 250 to 300,000 residents that we had to evacuate out of that area. We had 60,000 homes in the fire's path that were under threat. So there isn't time to sit and look for items that you need. This stuff needs to happen fast, and fortunately it did. There was an enormous amount of lives saved during this incident. There was an enormous structural save that happened, and you know, that's one of the things we want to highlight by having, you know, people who live in Malibu, they've seen this before, and they got up and they got out of there, and it was really critical. If they don't, the situation we run into, we were just talking to those Cal Fire chiefs, they had to bring in heavy equipment at some points to bulldoze vehicles out of the road so that we could get fire apparatus into the area to fight the fire. So if you wait too long, the situation you run into, and I'm sure everyone in this room, these firefighters here, we were all engineers at one time. We drove those fire engines into those fires, and I've personally been in situations where we're coming into the fire area, and as we're coming in, getting ready to set up and make a stand, we've got panicked residents that are trying to egress at the same time. Extremely hazardous. You can have vehicle collisions. You've got vehicles parked in front of hydrants. We're not able to secure the water sources that we need, and we're not able to engage the way we want to and utilize the tactics that we need to utilize to be effective.
There's something else I want to talk about, but before I do, is there anything else you want to say to those listening about what they should be thinking about?
I would like to talk a little bit about knowing where you're living. Know where you're at. You know, we love Southern California. We love putting our homes in these beautiful areas, these beautiful mountain ranges, these saddles, these chutes. It looks beautiful. However, you're putting them right in harm's way when it comes to wildfire. So if you're putting your house in these areas, go talk to your local firefighters, talk to your local stations. Say, find out what kind of fire behavior you have has happened in these areas in the past. Fire doesn't change. When the wind blows, it blows from the 101 to the PCH. So when you put your house in those areas, realize it. If a fire starts over upwind of where you're at, don't wait for us to tell you to go. Realize that you're in a harmful situation and you can leave. Your life isn't worth your house.
That's such an important thing to say. Your life is not worth your house, because oftentimes, and I've seen this time and time again, where you guys will ask for a mandatory evacuation and people want to stay on their roofs with hoses. And you can't make somebody do something they don't want to do. So if somebody says, well, I really don't want to leave, then it's your responsibility to say, okay, but I can't come and save you, because there's going to be a point where it's too dangerous for me to come in there and help you out. So now's the time, or you may be on your own, right? Because I've heard that before too.
First, it's important, I think, that Captain Brendan McGrath would totally agree that we understand the desire of an individual to stay behind and protect their home. Many of us live in this area. I was under evacuation warning, being a Thousand Oaks resident last week, so we get it. We also need the public to know that when we place these evacuation warnings, that we do so with a prediction of where that fire has gone historically, what the topography is, because fire will naturally move in those areas, and then really what's the weather in particular, not just the temperatures and the humidity, but where is that wind going? Then we put that and we predict ahead of that fire of areas of impact where communities can be in danger, and we tell people to get out. And when that happens, they need to go. And here's a big reason why. If you don't, now we have to protect life above property, right? So we're going to send firefighters in there to save a life if we need to. However, now you're not only jeopardizing your own life, being in that horrific environment, you're jeopardizing firefighters' lives. Those firefighters secondarily should be out protecting other structures from flame and to get ahead of those fires. So there's a big impact here. Please know that we get it. You want to stay there and protect your home, but you leaving gives the best chance for us to get large fire apparatus, equipment, members, hose lines into that area and to be able to do our job.
It's interesting to me, and maybe you guys have a thought on this, but it's interesting to me that we used to have something called a fire season. And we used to say on TV, and we're now into fire season and the Santa Anas are... But now it's like fire season all year long. What happened?
I think a lot of it has to do with that drought we've been in. 6 years continuous, going into a seventh. Our fuels are getting so low. I heard an interesting summary at one of our morning briefings. They were summarizing an 8-inch piece of fuel, a piece of tree, a timber, is just as dry as a 2x4. That's, in firefighter language, that's huge. That is super dry. Super explosive.
Yeah, the fuel moistures that we were used to seeing in October years ago, you know, now we're seeing them in the spring. And that's unprecedented. Low rainfall is really the critical factor here.
Is that to say that there's only one fire season and it's 12 months long?
Yes, but I think still when we get into the fall, there's always that added offshore wind component that we don't experience in the spring typically. The offshore winds, the Santa Ana winds in Southern California are always going to come in the fall. You know, that is one component that does not go year round. But, you know, those low fuel moistures and hot temperatures that you see, you know, in the spring a lot of the time and in other parts of the year, these fires, you know, like the station fire, if you remember, was not a wind-driven fire. And that fire was driven by topography and fuel. So in very steep, you know, hilly terrain and heavy fuels, you can still see that rapid rate of spread, and it doesn't have to be just a wind component. But once you move into the fall and you got this wind behind these fires, the explosive rate of spread is profound.
I'll tell you, you know, fire is for all my career, whether I was in radio or television, I have just, fire is an awful thing, but it's a good thing. We cook with it. You know, we do a lot of things with it. My phone rings while I'm talking about it. But I think, you know, I think that respect for fire is a very important thing to have and to understand just how powerful and dangerous fire can be when not controlled.
It's a living, breathing beast that is so important to bring heat and to cook food, and yet we all are well too well aware now of its devastating consequences.
A living, breathing beast. That's really a very interesting way to draw a picture. So now I want to do something. I want to talk about my daughter. What the hell, right? I want to talk about my daughter. My daughter,
it's your
Mara.
Show.
Hi, honey, if you're listening. She's concerned about, and I think a lot of people have respect for everybody on the fire line, prisoners, inmates, camp crews that go out there. And she and I have talked, and she's talked about how little they get, the recognition they may or may not get, the opportunities they don't have, because they've committed crimes, been convicted of crimes. So to sort of lay that out in a 1, 2, 3 bullet point, one, they only get, what, $1 an hour? Is it $1 a day?
You know, to be honest, I don't know.
Something like that.
Yeah, the compensation is not substantial.
Yeah, you can't even buy bubble gum anymore for $1, I don't
think.
And of course, they're very carefully chosen. They're nonviolent inmates. There have been some that have taken a hike, although they've been quickly caught in most cases, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I can speak a bit to this. You know, the CDF, now known as Cal Fire, used to supply us with those inmates. And there was a prison realignment that occurred a number of years ago, and now those state prisoners are now coming out of the county system, and they're trained inside of L.A. County. And we have a big training center up at Wayside Prison, L.A. County Sheriff's Facility up there near Castaic. And I've personally been there, and I can tell you that the program itself is actually a really positive program, because it's a tremendous rehabilitation program. If you go up there and you look at that training center, it's filled with inmates, low-level offenders that come in there, and a lot of these people are tradesmen. They're skilled, they're painters, they're artists, they're construction people. You go look at that training center, and they personally constructed it. It's very clean. It looks like almost like a military base. It's landscaped. They have the logos of all their different crews are painted on the walls, and there's a tremendous sense of camaraderie that these guys get in this program, and it is a rehabilitation tool. It's actually really amazing, and you see a lot of people come out of these programs, and they can go to work as wildland firefighters. You know, municipal agencies like us, it's challenging because it's already competitive, but they can go into the U.S. Forest Service as prior incarcerated offenders.
And they can?
Oh, yes.
Even though they've been convicted of, say, a felony?
In general, I don't believe that any the fire services will accept felons, but a lot of these people that are in those inmate crews do go on to work as Forest Service wildland firefighters.
Misdemeanor offenders?
Yes. They take each case individually, but I can tell you, most of the people that are in that program, they regard it as a privilege. And there's a camaraderie that comes with it and a team building.
Sense of pride.
Absolutely. And it's a very positive experience for most of those guys. If you talk to them, if you go up there and you look at that training center up at Wayside and you talk to some of these guys, they have the same kind of pride that we have as individual firefighters working as part of a company in the middle of the city.
When you have, we've kind of talked about this before, prisoners, oftentimes people thank firefighters. They send stuff to your fire stations. Kids draw pictures in their elementary schools. Thank you, firefighters, for saving my home. What about these crews, these inmates? Do they get that kind of attention? Can they? And if people wanted to thank them, how would they do that?
Well, you know, clearly they do not. You know, they're incarcerated. These guys are in jail. But I can tell you that, you know, as firefighters ourselves, we offer our respect up to them. And there's you know, a certain degree of camaraderie that exists between us and them out there on the line. But they are incarcerated. They are wearing orange suits. And they are clearly, you know, people that are out of the jail system up there. So, you know, it would be, dishonest to suggest that they're in the same situation that we are. But they are, I believe, in a situation where it's a privileged environment to be part of that. And the guys that are in there want to be in there. And it beats being in a jail cell. And they're out there, they're getting fit, and they're working as a team, and they're learning a skill. And there's that thing that brotherhood they get to experience that we get to experience. And it's very, it's invaluable. It's hard to put a price on that.
And it's guys and it's gals.
Yes.
It's women out there, too. I saw
L.A. County Camp 13 is an all-female inmate crew, and they do great work. I've been out there. I've seen them. They're a tremendous powerhouse of physical strength and prowess.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. I have taken the time to stop what I'm doing and just watch them and see what they're doing, and they are dedicated.
Yes.
They've been trained. They have a mission, and they're going to be successful at it because that's what their intent is, right?
Yes.
And so one more thing about that, because I think that it would be unfair if we didn't say that when people put those signs up, thank you, firefighters, they may also take some pride in that and believe that some of those good wishes are for them as well.
For sure, because the work they're doing is work that we need done. And it's cut in line, it's hard work. It's difficult work, and it's necessary. And without their assistance, we would not be as effective as we are.
And one of the things I thought Captain McGrath said earlier, which I thought was interesting, was when he passes them on the hill, he'll say, thanks for being here. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
What do they say back to you?
Well, they say thank you right back. You're welcome. They're usually very polite. You don't have a long conversation with them. But
they appreciate the fact you took a second.
They're very appreciative. And we also got to remember, they're not just on the fire lines with us. They're working logistics inside the camps, cooking our meals. So they're learning the whole aspect of how to build fire camps, how to how to learn how to cook, how to clean, how to do logistics. So they're in every part of that.
Do they get some good behavior credit for that? I don't know that you know, but I'm just kind of, it's popped into my head.
I think they have to have some good behavior even to be available to do it. I think that the point is here that there's a definite balance, right? These are individuals that have done something illegal, and that's why they're incarcerated, but they're an absolute part of our team. We respect what they do, and we use them to predominantly cut line, meaning that they're doing the arduous activity of really making a line around the fire perimeter near the, you know, the blackened line that was burned to the green that wasn't, and getting it down to bare mineral, so that way they're able to remove all the vegetation and it reduces the spread of the fire coming through. We're not using these individuals to be an incident commander, to be orchestrating what divisions and operational plans and tactics are going to take place. But when you do see a sign on the roadside to thank firefighters, they absolutely feel a sense of pride in that, and they are part of the team.
All right, let's start with you, Eric, a final thought.
What's the topic?
Fires.
That's broad. You know, I think a couple things, there are so many great points that were brought up. I think to piggyback on a couple of things that Kent McGrath and Brenda said too is if we touch base on brush clearance, it's so important for the people to know that it works. And I'm going to give you one statistic. In the Latuna fire, 1,400 homes came within 200 feet of flames. Only 5 were destroyed. That's 0.3%. And a big part of that success was having proper brush clearance. So let's make sure folks know that it works, and that way they're able to ensure that they let that take place. The other thing to bring up on is my fellow captains were talking about driving an apparatus in these hilly areas. Right now we're in a studio in Fox 11. This is LA territory. This is my territory, right?
We're in your hood.
That's right. And an important thing for people out here to know is that there's red flag warnings from National Weather Service when you get, you know, your bad winds and heat. But there's also red flag parking restrictions that's unique to Los Angeles. And the reason they have that is in areas that are prone to wildfires coming through, where there's hairpin turns, there's narrow roads, and essentially choke points to where you had try to have an individual evacuating, you know, mom's minivan out and us bringing big red fire engine in, we're not going to happen. So what will happen in Los Angeles is, like, for instance, during the Woolsey fire that everyone is familiar with, we enacted parking restrictions. So there's well posted areas in those choke points throughout Mulholland Drive, Hollywood Hills, throughout all these areas. People need to know that is enacted, and that they cannot park on those days, because simply put, we cannot have people driving down while we're driving up. It's an impossibility. You look at Kirkwood Bowl; those individuals flat out are going to likely be evacuating on foot. A lot of these hillside homes in California that are so gorgeous in these areas were built for Model A's, not for a Chevy Suburban. So you even just watch a trash truck go up there, and it's they're nearly scraping. So people in LA need to know that. They need to know that's an issue. They need to know if they live in those areas that they need to not park there when there's red flag parking restrictions, and to make sure that they get out early.
So that's LA City. Let's go to Ventura County.
I would like to touch on a little bit about Ready, Set, Go. We talked about it earlier. Get your properties ready. Not just the ones that are right next to the urban interface. Any house, wherever you're at, clean up your trash around your house. Take a look at the bushes. Take a look at your attic vents. That can fire get into your attic? Be ready. Also have be set. So that way you have all your medications. You have all your clothes packed. You have water to go. You know where you're going to go. You know your evacuation routes. And when you're asked to go, go. Don't wait. Don't hang out for us. If you know you're in a bad area, go early. Lastly, I would definitely like to thank the two departments I have with me here today, LA City, LA County, Ventura County. We work so well together. I'm so proud to be in this room representing the area. These are some of the finest firefighters in Southern California.
Right
and
back
I'm
at
very
you,
happy to be here with them.
Tony?
That's actually really the direction I wanted to go with this, is I think, you know, the citizens of this area here in Southern California can be really proud, because, you know, we have three of the finest agencies in the entire world here, And the way that we work together is something to see. I worked with these two men right at the beginning of this fire, right when it started. And it was a team that was put together on the fly, and it functioned really seamlessly throughout this entire incident. I've worked alongside LA City firefighters throughout my career, working down at South Central in the Hollywood areas, and we work together in an impressive fashion. And I think the citizens can be really proud of the resources that we have here and the seamless functioning that these agencies have with one another and the spirit. You know, you could see out there at that incident, we were sleep deprived. Everybody was really, really beat up, but the esprit de corps, you know, amongst us all, and the way that we all lifted each other up and the way we worked together was impressive. And like Captain McGrath here says, you know, I'm very proud to be part of this this operation, because it was, I believe, a tremendous success. And there was tens of thousands of lives that were saved during this incident in specific. And you know, people can be proud of what we have here in Southern California. It's evolved into really a tremendous force and for life safety. It's really pretty powerful.
So listen to some of what they had to say. Good advice, good information. Really a bunch of great guys. All right, thanks for joining us here on What the Hell. If you haven't subscribed already, please do. And then you'll be notified every time we have one of these come up, which is about every week. And also, give us 5 stars. You can give us 5.5 if you want to. What the hell, right? All right, see you next time. Thanks for joining us.